the socialist Fabian philosophy of the eternal conflict between labor and capital. Marxism has had more influence, has had as much, if not more influence in this country than it has in Russia. Because, and you have therefore the job provider is your enemy. And I've been very successful running industrial plants without unions, where the workers appreciate the job provider and the job provider appreciates them, and they get along beautifully together. and they work. I mean, a day goes faster and more healthily for a worker doing as much as he can within his energy level, and talent level. His day goes better and it's easier than like when I did a study. Let's see, was it at the time of the jobs book? Yes. I was very friendly with the president of the local union at the Universal Cyclops Company in Bridgeville. And he had a name like Bukovich or Frankovich, something like that. Very fine man. And I went to see him as a person, human person to person. He says, hey, I can't talk to you. He says, I know what's the problem. At that time, he'd been transferred over to the rolling mill, rolling alloy steel, or rolling non-steel, you know, titanium thing, where iron, Fe steel, is an impurity. In 2-3 hours under the incentive system, he made his $100 for the day, and that's all he worked. He said, you know, he didn't work anymore. It maybe put in 3 hours, 3.5. Well, was it of such a work that you couldn't do 7 hours a day? Well, you can make a case for that. I looked at U.S. Steel wanted to sell a plant they had in Lawrenceville. I don't know whether it's still going or not. They made these big steel towers that carry the transmission lines. You see them along the highways. Mm-hmm. And it's dominated by, there wasn't a black worker in it, dominated by the men from Polish Hill. And they really pegged the production there, and they went around there like stepping and fetching. They were galvanizing these poles in the big zinc bath, and we watched them for a couple hours and talked to them, and that's what the union was for. The union was there to stretch her out, provide as many jobs as you can.
What do you think it would take to develop a kind of situation that you feel would...
I tried here to do it. I couldn't change enough thinkings. I couldn't change enough things. We moved our auto factory from New York State down to South Carolina, where we already had a factory with 500, 600 people there, and they didn't know about the class struggle. They never heard about this business. They were grateful for a job provider. Hell, all they had before that was picking tobacco or working in the tobacco warehouse. You had a job. Not only that, we bring them into a factory that's air-conditioned. My God, we only had 500 or 600 jobs. We had 4,000 or 5,000 applicants. We had people from all over the place, people making pantyhose, people making the knitting mills and the spinning mills. They're all coming over to our place. And so... And they appreciated it, and we had incentive system up north. We just took the incentive production and we made it the norm down there. They didn't know any different. That's just what they produced. We never put an incentive system in, individual incentive system, which I don't believe in anymore anyway. The group incentives are the way to do it. And So I don't see any hope of changing the basic attitudes of the third and fourth generation industrial worker generation here.
It's just a fact of life.
Yeah, but yet it can be done. Now here's some labs that took over and they put in a galvanizing plant down here on 2nd Street. It's non-union, but it's made up of workers from this area. I know we use galvanneal in our business, but they don't do galvanneal. They used to do hot dipping, galvanized, and they apparently are doing all right. But Dad, I won't be surprised if the place goes on strike. I wouldn't be surprised if it goes on strike. All the fellows running it have all been trained in the social sciences at MIT and places, and they know their way around the group dynamics, and so they are engaged in practices that eliminate the need for a protective organization, which is a labor.
Maybe they'll succeed.
They haven't been on strike yet.
You've had such an incredibly complex and productive career, Mr. Rutenberg. I'm certain many honors and awards have come your way. Can you tell us some we should note here for the record?
Not really, not any. I don't know of any of them. Nobody paid any attention to me. I just go on. I haven't, and I don't engage in the in community activities where they honor you and all that kind of stuff. Never had a testimonial dinner, and never had any honors of any kind that I know of.
How about any significant conferences that you participated in here or in Israel that we haven't covered before? Of great importance.
Well, economic conferences were a real activity on my part in Israel from 1967 to 1973. They still go on in another form, but by bigger people, as I explained before, by the Bronfmans and the Taubmans and the Max Fishers. My group, we were a smaller group, capital-wise, and so on, but we made our contributions to the industry of the country. Now they're going on. Other than that, I don't suppose there's anything. The labor movement, I was in it for a dozen years.
Can you tell us more, your personal insights, if you will, about prominent labor leaders you have known, such as Lewis, Murray?
Well, I knew all the original labor leaders of the CIO, Sidney Hillman, and Joseph Schlossberg, who I explained before, was secretary of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers under Sidney Hillman, and he was the one that introduced me to Zionism, labor Zionism, in the 30s. And, of course, Dubinsky and Antonucci was the vice president, Italian vice president. It's interesting the constituency of those unions, how they change. Howard was the head of the Typographical Workers Union. Lewis, I knew Lewis quite well. My brother Stanley worked directly for him for several years. But I always had a strong position with Lewis, and he always welcomed and tolerated my contrary views, because I always, I learned early to confine your don't criticize unless you've got an alternative to propose. If you don't have an alternative to propose, why? You haven't any basis to criticize someone else's action or their policy. So I always follow that, and he always listened to me. And I talked to him in his late years after he became a banker. You know, he quit being a labor leader, became a banker. Without leaving the labor movement, he just used the union's money to buy that bank down there. And I just see where a couple years ago when Trump, the president head of the mine workers union, he sold off. He got their money out of the bank, I think, and rightly so. But Lewis became a banker.
Which of them do you feel made significant contributions to the...
Well, Lewis, of course, was a man of action. He was the he was the leader. Of course, Phil Murray had a touch of greatness to him, a bit of Abe Lincoln. Phil Murray, that Lewis didn't have. Lewis was a cynic, whereas Murray was a believer. Murray was a churchgoer, and Lewis referred to them as the clergy as business agents of God, and such other derogatory observations. But Lewis was the effective leader. Sidney Hillman was a creation of the social workers from the community houses in Chicago and New York. They picked him and made him a labor leader. Otherwise,
guys that have been just another boy along the road. It's a creation of the social workers, the Jewish social workers, in those community houses. Of course, Charlotte, Adam, what was her name? Big social worker in the Hull House. Adams, what was her name? The big social worker in Hull House in Chicago. Adams, I mean, her name was Adams, I'm sure of that. Kitty will remember. I know a good friend of ours who was Secretary of Labor here under Gift Pinchot. When he was governor, her name was Charlotte Carr. And she'd been police commissioner in New York City. And then Jane Adams. And she succeeded Jane Adams at Hull House. Or she came after Jane Adams at Hull House. And my brother Stanley, since I knew Charlotte, my brother Stanley got him a job as an organizer with the CIO. Then in 1938, the recession came and they laid him and other laborers off. And for a year, I got him a job with Charlotte Carr out at Hull House. And from there, I got him into the economic research department of the CIO in Washington.
At this point, Mr. Rutenberg, how do you view your accomplishments? What do you consider your most important successes?
Oh, well, they're all personal. 50-year marriage is probably the biggest thing. The children come next. Have nothing to do directly with the grandchildren except our contribution towards one of their parents.
We're talking about your professional career.
Oh, I guess the only movement of any social consequence I belonged to was the steelworkers, the labor movement. I mean, when you go into business, why then each business is a little world unto itself. And while you live in the community, why the community doesn't know about your little world. And you don't have much to do with the community. My background didn't give me the incentive, like friends and schoolmates of mine who had an incentive coming from poor families to prove that, to engage in community activity for recognition.
In retrospect, what was the greatest challenge?
I'll tell you my biggest mistake. Biggest mistake in 1950 when I wanted to go and become an Israeli and live in Israel. That was the biggest mistake I made in my life, but my wife wasn't ready for it yet. She didn't become ready for it until 67 or so, which was 17 years too late.
You regret that?
Oh, that was the biggest mistake of my life. I should have become an Israeli then. So my heart is there in Israel and my soul is in Jerusalem. And the biggest mistake is for accomplishments. I haven't accomplished very much. I mean, yes, I make money, but what the hell? Some of the dumbest clucks I've met are wealthy people. I mean, money comes to people who either because they have the courage or the foolhardiness, they take risks, and then forces beyond their control determine whether they win, lose, or draw. Andy Carnegie wasn't any great, brilliant guy. He just came along at a time. He came along at a time whenever steel was needed for the railroad industry. When you take steel, you know, big tonnages of steel for rails and railroad cars and locomotives are there. Not much of that anymore. And then the lumber barons, you know, hell, they come to town whenever they get raped the forests, and the natural resources people, there's quite a book on Getty, what a stoop he was. He just fell into bribing the Arab sheiks down there and pointing to their eagles and getting oil concessions and so on. So I don't consider that any accomplishment.
Is there any other information you care to add in conclusion?
But except on accomplishments, I have in each industry, I have created new products that didn't exist before.
Well, that's an accomplishment.
Yes. I created or I grabbed a hold of an engineer's development and I put it on the market. You go to the supermarket and you get one of these high boy carts with a basket that pulls up. I brought that. I'm the man that brought that to America. Also, I brought the nylon and moved to acrylic coating of wire. We have wire shelves in our closets that don't gather dust like wooden shelves do. I mean, I've done things like that in the drilling machine business, but they're small things. What was the last question there?
I think that was about it.
Yeah.
I think perhaps I asked what you would do differently, and you said you wouldn't have become an Israeli.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's the biggest mistake I made in my life.
Well, thank you for a most interesting interview.
Thank you. Fine. My pleasure.
I know it'll be a significant addition to Council's collection of oral history tapes in the archives at Hillman Library.
Yeah, let's hope so.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You're more than welcome. It's been a pleasure to meet you and to work with you here. And
we certainly enjoyed it.
Let's see whether we can get her off the telephone. I have some chocolate chip cookies.